Hey, before we get started, does your email provider offer this? Check out the top of dnamail.com. There's a phone number with 24 hours a day, 7 days a week support. What happens right now if your email goes down? What does it mean to your business? What happens as you wait for somebody to fix the problem? Try dnamail.com. They're the experts when it comes to handling email. They'll give you a hosted exchange solution, and they'll have somebody in Los Angeles ready, standing by the phone in case you have any issues or questions. And if you need Google Apps, they'll do that for you too. DNAmail.com. All right, check out also 99 Designs. I showed you all the designs that I got when I was a customer of 99 Designs. Check out what Troy Simpson sent me. He was listening to me talk about 99 Designs. He said, hey, I used it and look at all the designs that I got. Now, if you use 99 Designs, here's all you do. You go onto the website and you describe the design you need. Do you need a logo? Do you need a web page? Do you need a template? Do you need some other design? You describe it and then you'll get showered with designs. You'll give the designers feedback. You'll get showered with even more designs. You'll give them more feedback and they'll really just hone in on what you need. Once you pick that right design, you only pay for the design that you want, and you only pay what you agreed to pay. There's no standard fee there. 99 Designs will even guarantee that if you don't like any of the designs, they'll give you your money back. 99designs.com, I use them, Troy uses them, many people in my audience and many of the guests on Mixergy have tried them and used them and loved them, and I hope you do too. 99designs.com. Finally, Grasshopper. I hope that by now you understand that Grasshopper is not just a standard phone number. It's a virtual phone system, which means if you need a new extension, you could set that up for yourself quickly. If you have a new hire, if you have a new department, if you want to just create a fictitious department to give your company the air of size to make it look big, you just go to grasshopper.com and you can add all of that. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love for a reason. Check it out and you'll see for yourself. Grasshopper.com. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. Guys, do you remember the day when the iPad came out? How the world was just transfixed by this new device? They were all paying attention to Steve Jobs. They were all loving Apple. And then all those other computer manufacturers out there, the guys who had their tablets for years, who had their slates, who had their this and their that, all seemed like black and white, old-fashioned versions of what was going on today. The reason I'm saying that is because I want my business, I want myself, I want my life to be that fascinating, that exciting, and I want the same thing for my audience. And my guess is, if you guys are listening to a program like this, if you even figured out how to find me online and how to find me on iTunes and put me on whatever device you happen to have, you want the same thing for yourself. So how do we get you to be that fascinating? How do we get you to be that persuasive, that attention getting? Well, to learn how to do it, I invited today Sally Hogshead. She is the author of Fascinate, Your 7 Triggers to Persuasion and Captivation. Sally, welcome to Mixergy, and thanks for coming here to teach us.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm so happy to be with you today.
Sally, let's make a promise to the audience early on in the program. If they listen to this program from beginning to end, and or if they go and buy your book, Fascinate, and read that from beginning to end and actually apply all this, what's in it for them?
They're going to understand that in any type of competitive environment, whether that competitive environment means they're launching into a category that already has a lot of competitors, or they're looking for a job in a field in which a lot of people want to be able to break in or succeed, or even if they're trying to develop stronger relationships with their own children because their kids seem to be more interested in Nintendo or Harry Potter. If they understand the concept of fascination and they can understand how to take their natural brand strengths and apply it, they're going to be able to communicate in a way that is heard, remembered, and acted upon.
Okay, I gave an example that I think feels too far out of reach for most people, and maybe they're a little too familiar with it. Steve Jobs, yeah, we'd all love to be Steve Jobs. It's not going to happen anymore. Then we're going to become Batman or Superman. Do you have an example that's a little more within reach that also will show us what happens when we take all these ideas, internalize them, and use them?
We all have too much information coming at us. We're overwhelmed. We're confused. We feel as though our inboxes are too full. There are too many choices on iTunes. How do we make decisions about which things we're going to choose? Which options are we going to ignore, and which ones are going to become our new favorites? The truth is, the ones that we choose, the winners are the ones that fascinate us. Now, this can mean that it fascinates us with a rational benefit by being, say, for example, the lowest cost or the ones that we habitually buy. But more likely, it's going to speak to us emotionally. There's going to be something that brings out some type of a visceral response, an instinctive, involuntary response. The iPad, which you mentioned, it evokes one of the seven triggers. Actually, it evokes many of the seven triggers, but it evokes lust. Lust is one of the triggers that's about the way the iPad feels in the hand, the way the navigation works, the mystique of how Steve Jobs released it. When we think of the products that we pick off the shelves, the employees that we hire and promote, or the friends that we feel the closest to, it all comes down to these seven different triggers that I talk about in the book.
Do you have a specific example beyond the iPad of someone who's doing this well, someone who's provoking lust or provoking any of the other seven triggers that you mentioned in the book?
Sure. Well, I was in Starbucks this morning, and Starbucks initially was about prestige, because if you were carrying a Starbucks cup down the street, that logo meant something about you. It meant that you were elevated, that you were choosing something other than getting your coffee at home. Then, as the category has matured and evolved, Starbucks has started to become less about prestige and more about trust, understanding that you're going to get exactly the same drink whether you're ordering it in Mumbai or in Montana. And it's also they had a promise, this new guarantee that they've really been promoting, that if there's anything wrong with your drink at any point, if it doesn't meet your satisfaction, anytime, any Starbucks location, they want to know about it. And they're evoking the trust trigger through consistency and reliability of experience. That's something that anybody can relate to, that feeling of the sense of knowing exactly what you're buying into with Starbucks.
I see. Okay. Does it have to be on such a big level where you have operators standing by to take in complaints, and where people are, where does it have to be a company as big as Starbucks with all their resources to evoke trust? Or can I, for example, start evoking trust here with Mixergy by putting on a program every day, every weekday, and focusing it on entrepreneurship and focusing it on ambitious topics? I mean, what I'm saying is this something that we can achieve, or do we need to be as big as Starbucks in order to get there?
Well, trust is an unusual trigger. Of the seven triggers, trust is the most difficult to achieve, but it requires tremendous consistency. So one of the great things about Mixergy is that when people come to the site, they know exactly the type of topic that you're going to be talking about, even though you have a lot of different variants and the type of guests that you have. The format is consistent. It's consistently good, but you have to earn that. You didn't get that your very first day. Trust is not something that people can take away immediately. In our research, we found that trust is 8 times more important than any other trigger in long-term relationships. Now, on the other hand, not everybody can have trust. So for startups and entrepreneurs, it's very difficult to use the trust trigger immediately, because it's something that it takes months or even years to be able to develop, because people need to neurologically be able to know what to expect from you and from your brand. What a trigger that you might choose instead would be the vice trigger. The vice trigger is all about forbidden fruit and tweaking rules, going against expectations. So when somebody, if in using creativity or having an untraditional type of format, you'd be using the vice trigger to bring people into your conversation.
Okay, so we've mentioned some of the seven triggers. What are they? What are all seven triggers?
The first one is power, and power is about authority and command. Power is what makes us obey and respect. The second one is mystique. Mystique is about a puzzle, a piece of missing information. We want to know the answer. So when someone says, tune in later, get the answer, that's what makes us want to be able to fill in the blank. The next one is lust, which we talked about. Lust is sensory experience, using the five senses to be able to bring someone into an experience that they crave. So if you crave a certain sports car, or you crave a certain pair of shoes, that's lust at work. Then there's alarm. And alarm is the threat of negative consequences. You go on a diet or brush your teeth or watch your cholesterol because of the alarm trigger. Alarm incites people to act, because it threatens them with what could go wrong if they don't. Then there is prestige, which is elevating something, a person or idea or company, based on being above other people, based on respect among peers and ranking. Then there's vice, which is a personal favorite of mine. Vice is a very powerful trigger among people who need to break the status quo. So anybody who reinvents a type of thinking, anybody who brings a fresh perspective to a category, anybody from Ansel Adams, Andy Warhol, anybody who is reinventing a traditional way of performing and bringing something fresh to the category is using vice. And then finally, trust, which we talked about, the consistency of experience.
Okay, and I've got them up on my screen, but I wrote them down in the order that you just gave them. I thought what we could do is go through each one individually, come up with an example of somebody who's doing them well, and then talk about how someone in my audience can use them. So let's start with power. Who's using power well?
Power is something that we see among companies that already have a very established presence. Mm-hmm. People who have weight that they can bring to any type of negotiation, or who have a solid reputation based on a political clout or financial clout. So when we look at Bono, for example, the Bono brand has gone from prestige and vice to now using power to take all this brand equity that he's earned and starting to apply it and use it and allocate it as capital against all of these different causes that he's dedicated to. It's about the power and influence that he commands, not only through his music, it's so much far beyond that now. Now it's about being able to exert authority and being able to change other people's behavior specifically because of the command that he has.
Because if they don't do what he thinks is right for the world, he will call out politicians and business people and other organizations and say, guys, to his fans, this is wrong. And that's the power that he has.
Yeah, well, it's that, and it's also the fact that he can mobilize people. He can incite action. One of the differences between traditional messaging and fascination messaging is that it's about action. If it's about decision and behavior, mm-hmm. If something doesn't change behavior, then it's not fascinating. It's one of the criteria. So Bono, actually, it's not just about passively listening. It's about getting people to change the way they not only think, but the way they spend their money or the way they dedicate their time.
All right, maybe at this point we should talk about what it means to fascinate, because I came into researching you with the idea that fascinate means be so interesting that people's jaw drops and they just start staring. But that's not what we're talking about here. What do you mean by fascinate?
To be honest, I thought fascination was about jaw-dropping attraction when I started also. But the reality is I spent 3 years researching it and found out that it's much more than that. Let me take a quick step back, if I may. Mm-hmm. I began 3 years ago in 2006 researching why do we pay attention to certain things and not others? Why do we act on certain messages and not others? And what I found is that across time, throughout cultures, no matter where you go on the globe, in any era of civilization, there are very specific things that compel us to act. It's innate in the way we're hardwired as humans. Neurologically, we're born with these triggers. We're born with certain reasons why we respond to certain things and not to others. Some of it comes down to survival. Some of it comes down to attraction and mating. Some of it comes down to acquiring food or acquiring resources. But all of it applies to the way in which marketing works today on a much bigger level that we have somehow forgotten. The concept of fascination is consistent throughout, going all of the way back to ancient Romans. It's one of the very first words that the Romans talk about, fascinare. Fascinare was the ability to bewitch someone so irresistibly that they couldn't deny your message, that you were brainwashing them with witchcraft. And this word continues all the way through the Salem witch trials. Sigmund Freud talks about it again and again, until suddenly, in the middle of the 20th century, we stopped thinking about fascination, and we began thinking about marketing. And the difference is that fascination is something that's innate. We give ourselves over to it. It's involuntary. Whereas marketing is something, it's a rational message that's directed from the company to the consumer, or from the authority, from the New York Times or Encyclopedia Britannica down to the consumer. Well, now it's no longer about the New York Times and Encyclopedia Britannica. Now Now it's about blogs and Mixergy and Wikipedia and other ways of earning somebody's trust and changing their behavior. So in thinking about how things compete in any type of a competitive environment, any environment from the Amazon jungle where you have hundreds of thousands of species competing for food and light and mates, all the way through to Amazon.com where you have millions of books that are screaming for attention on the website. The way we make those decisions comes down to which ones are most fascinating, and it all can be boiled down into these seven buckets that I call the triggers.
I see. And so these are compelling. They touch in eight aspects of who we are, and we may not even be aware of them when we're making decisions based on these seven triggers. I might say I like Amazon because they have the best selection of books, or because that's the place that, because they have the lowest prices. But what's really happening is I'm not checking out to see if they have the low prices anymore. There's something about them. It's probably that I trust them, and so I don't even bother comparing them. And it's probably some of these other triggers too at play, is what you're saying.
Yes, and it's even when you go on to Amazon, why do you buy some books over another? When you go to the aisle and you're buying creamed corn, why do you buy some over another? When your child is deciding whether or not to do drugs, there's a decision that has to happen based on these triggers. And if you can understand why we're motivated by certain triggers, why is it that certain things speak to us so profoundly, whether we realize it or not, that we're compelled to act, those are the triggers that work. And if you can understand the triggers that you're responding to and the triggers that you're enacting, that you're eliciting in other people, then you can have a much greater control over behavior, your own and that of other people.
Okay, let's move on then to mystique. Do you have an example of somebody who uses mystique well?
I do. Now, let me ask you, we talked before about beverages. Have you ever had Jägermeister liqueur?
Yeah, absolutely.
How would you describe it?
It's gross. It's gross. It's hard to drink, but I've got to say that I still drink it.
Okay, thank you. Perfect. So most people hate the taste of Jägermeister. It tastes sort of like kerosene mixed with black chocolate, melted crayons, and it's revolting. But we drink it because of the mystique, because there's this air about it, this allure that makes us want to be part of an experience that's that intriguing. Some people say that Jägermeister has elk's blood. Other people say that it has opiates or crushed Valium. And nobody knows for sure because the company won't release the information, and the FDA has tried to make them release it, and they won't. Because the reason why people drink Jägermeister, it has nothing to do with rational product benefits. It has everything to do with this feeling that we have when we're part of a group, when we're at a bachelor party or we're at a birthday or somebody loses a bet. It's a group bonding activity that people become part of it. And if the brand tasted good, if this drink was actually delicious, I doubt it would be so popular. The brand is the number 9th most popular spirit. Wow. So it's growing at an extraordinary rate, and it continues to grow, even though many people don't like the taste, specifically because it evokes this trigger of mystique. We can't explain why we drink Jägermeister. We only know that we do, we have, and we probably, once again, against our better judgment, will at another time.
Okay, so now how can we manufacture that kind of trigger? If we're building a business or building a brand or writing a book or doing a podcast or doing a blog, how do we manufacture mystique? How do we make sure that it's in there?
Mystique is about questions instead of answers. So instead of announcing all the information, give just enough information that it doesn't complete the circle so that people need to come back for more. The people that create mystique, or the companies, we want to find out what makes them tick. We want to know. We want to be able to get in there and research. So once you successfully create mystique, companies and brands are more likely to be researched by consumers. The consumers are more likely to go into the store to be able to experience. They're more likely to talk about it because they're on a fact-finding mission. When the television series Lost at the end of the season, when they have a cliffhanger and they don't tell you what's going to be happening, and the whole time until you can see the next episode, you want to find out what is the completion to the mystery, that's mystique at work. It's a very, very powerful force that we don't have any control over, because it's stronger than curiosity. It's a motivator that that drives us to do things that don't seem like it's rational. So when a company wants to find out what Apple is about to release as its next product, that people are going to be going through the trash of the Apple buildings to see what patents they've been filing for. In the same way, if a wife wants to know if her husband is having an affair, she might be counting the Viagra pills in his prescription bottle. It's trying to solve a mystery and crack a code.
I see. By the way, speaking of Lost, you're right. It has that mystique. I'm now here in Buenos Aires. I don't really have a TV. It's a pain in the neck to get to watch anything. I've been downloading every episode of Lost. And I don't even like the show. I just need to know what's the island about? Why are they on there? Who are these others?
Right,
what else is
right.
going on?
We all do this. We talk about what really went on between Marilyn Monroe and JFK. What really happened with some of the great conspiracy theories. We want to know, and so we talk about it a lot. And it's a great way to get people talking about your brand, especially on Twitter, because it allows for real time conversation and information exchange back and forth.
Okay. Let's see, actually, I see a lot of activity here in the chat room around this. She agreed to say, good. I think people are looking for let's take one of the most bland, boring, let's talk about blogs, how this could be applied to blogs. And the reason I want to say it to blogging, because there's just so many of them out there. How can you apply mystique to a blog?
Actually, I think this might be a valuable exercise to go through all of the triggers, because this will give people some granular application.
Okay.
So this is off the top of my head. If we were going to use the mystique trigger, what you would do is, if you look at the way Chris Brogan's blog works, he often ends with a question. He throws it out to the audience and says, well, what do you think? He's asking a question to bring people in to participate. Brand participation is all about getting people to engage and interact and involve. And the way to do that is not by giving away all the information, but to allow people to bring what they have to do it. Another thing you could do is, instead of simply reporting the way journalism would work, is to start a conversation. On my Facebook page, almost every single day, I ask a question. Some days the questions are very intense from a business perspective. Today the question is, if you were a punctuation mark, what punctuation mark would you be? I am an exclamation point, in case you're curious. And it allows for dialogue so that people can start to join into the discussion. Social media at its core has to have mystique baked in to the way people use the content in a way that's different than any other form of media. Newspapers wouldn't use mystique in the same way. Do you want to go on and use a couple of other examples of triggers?
Yeah, sure. Someone in the audience brought up an e-commerce site. Let's say you're selling online, you want to add mystique. What do you do?
This is an interesting challenge, because e-commerce is all about information. People are on a fact-finding mission, and so they want to be able to go to the e-commerce site to have their questions answered. They want immediacy, and if they don't get immediacy, then they probably aren't going to check out. And so what you might want to do is, the way in which you draw the traffic to the e-commerce site, that's where you would probably want to have the mystique. You would want to say, what's our deal of the day? It's 80% off, and we're not going to tell you what it is, but click here and find out. Travelzoo uses that. Haute Couture uses this. There are a lot of sites out there right now where they're not going to tell you what it is. You have to go to the site to be able to find it. Now, once you're there at the site, then they start to transition to different triggers. They might use alarm by saying, we only have 10 items left. If you want this item, you have to buy it now. So they're inciting in you, even if you didn't really need something, even if you didn't need the item that, the $200 flip-flops from Trina Turk that are on for sale right now, but they're only 10 left, and oh my God, if I don't order it right now, I'm not going to get it. That would be the alarm trigger. If they were going to be using the prestige trigger in an e-commerce site, that would say, we have brands that are not represented by any other e-commerce site. So Gilt Group might say, you're going to be able to get first dibs on this season's collection, and you can't get it anywhere else. So we're offering something that nobody else is offering. If they were going to be using the lust trigger, they would have a lot of photography. Zappos started bringing lust in when they gave consumers a better experience of the product. So instead of just a regular photograph, the way you would normally find on Amazon.com, by having things like 360-degree views and showing it on a model so you can see what it looks like, giving people a feeling of the sense of holding it. You know, when Steve Jobs released the iPad, which we talked about at the beginning, we didn't just see it against white. All the photography in the press was Steve Jobs physically holding it. So we saw that gorgeous, slender device, and it made us crave it more. Is this useful? Do you want
Absolutely.
To continue on?
Absolutely. I'm looking at the audience. They love this. Andy Dang is saying, I like this. Michael Rakowski, when we were talking about Mystique, said, Woot and Amazon Gold Box do it really well. It's true. I had to tear myself away from Woot a while back because every day I'd go over to the website just to see what the new product was.
Right,
I said, that's
right.
Just a waste of my time. I don't even
well,
need to
here's
buy it.
Wait, hold on. Here's the thing. The proof that it's fascination and not a traditional message is evidenced by the fact that it's a waste of your time and you do it anyway. It doesn't make sense. There are four things that distinguish things that are fascinating. They're innate. Fascination is innate. Like, you don't choose what you're fascinated by. You don't choose to be fascinated by chocolate versus broccoli. It's just, your brain does it automatically. It's innate. You were born with it. You can't train yourself for it. This is something that gets down to the very core of our humanness. It's involuntary that we have this feeling that even though I know I should be doing my CPS, TPS report, but instead I'm going to be checking out Facebook. And it's instinctive. We all have these triggers in common. So the fact that somebody was commenting that they don't know why they're going over to this website and spending time and checking out a deal on a product that they may never even buy, but somehow they're compelled, it's because that brand has very effectively activated the trigger deep within you that's innate, involuntary, and all the other things that differentiate fascination from other messaging.
I see. Okay. So if I wanted to use this on Mixergy, instead of announcing every single guest that I've got coming up into the future, what I might want to do instead is say, we're going to have mystery guests on Fridays. Every Friday,
Ooh,
we're going to have somebody in the industry, you know the person, but I'm not going to tell you who they are.
Yes. Now you would be mixing. Here's some example. You could take, let's get a little more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
You would be using Mystique if you said, I'm not going to tell you who it is on Friday. But you'd be mixing Mystique with Prestige if you said, this is a New York Times best-selling author. You own this book, but I'm not going to tell you who it is. You would be mixing Mystique with Alarm if you said, I'm not going to tell you who it is, and only the first 100 applicants can get in. In other words, you're putting the threat of negative consequences in with Mystique. You would be using Lust if you would say, I'm not going to tell you who it is, but somebody's going to get to fly in person to experience and the eye contact and in-person quality of getting to know this person.
I love it. I love how we can just take an idea, how you can take an idea and just apply all these techniques to it.
Can I pause there to say one thing?
Uh-huh.
This is really where the triggers start becoming most practical in their application, is that if you're trying to either brainstorm or develop a new type of messaging or tweak any type of a message, you can in a very literal way go through and start saying, how would we apply Mystique to our brand and our message exactly the way that you just did with Mixergy, and then layering in other triggers to see how you can begin to refine it. And what it does is it opens up all of these options that speak to people in a really powerful, visceral way that they cannot resist if you do it effectively. If you figure out which trigger combination is going to be most effective for your message and for your audience, what they need to hear, it's unbeatable.
I see. You know what? I could see using this to brainstorm. I could see putting all seven up on a wall, sitting down and saying, okay, what's the first one that we're going to add to what we're creating? What's the next one? How do we layer the third one in?
Yes. And like, there are times when it would be appropriate for Mixergy to keep your prestige very, very high, because people know there's going to be a certain level in terms of the production, mm-hmm. in terms of the background research that you've done, in terms of the quality of the guest and the dialogue. So the prestige is always going to be high. The Lust is high in video versus text, because instead of doing a traditional Q&A, you do it all on video, and the way it's produced is very visually pleasing. But you don't necessarily use Alarm, so that you might look at this and say, okay, Alarm is dormant. How could we turn that up a little bit when it's appropriate? When you want to drive a lot of traffic very quickly for a very specific thing, that might be a time to introduce a trigger that you're not using.
I see Andy Serrera in the audience is saying, I'm buying this book ASAP. Incredible.
Woo! Andy, I love you.
All right. So now when Anthony goes out and gets the book and try, is it Anthony or Andy who said this? Sorry, Andy Dang is loving you and Anthony Serrera are loving the, they're both loving the ideas here. Thank you guys. I really love the feedback that I get during the interviews. Let's say both Andy and Anthony go out and they get a copy of the book each and they want to start using these ideas, these triggers in their business. How many triggers can they add to a product? How many is too many? What's reasonable to add?
That's a great question. You should start small. More triggers is not better. And overusing one trigger is not better. The trick is to very specifically define how you want to take a trigger and apply it. Because each trigger elicits a different response. Power pushes others down. Prestige elevates you up. Alarm pushes them to act more quickly. Mystique pulls them towards you. Lust makes them want to interact with you. Vice makes them break their usual rules. So they're going to do something that's different than their habits or the way they were taught. By, say, if you're competing against Kellogg's or AT&T or IBM, you must use lust. So if you're not the category leader, Vice. If you're not the category leader, you have to use Vice. But when you can start to plot it out like that, and in part three of the book, I very specifically give exercises that show you on a really hands-on nuts and bolts level, how do you make this happen? Then you can begin to see that there are possibilities for your messaging that you wouldn't have considered otherwise.
All right, let's go back to this, to the list. We talked about lust, we talked about alarm, but let's spend a little more time on alarm. Is alarm just about having limited quantities and limited time?
No, that's a great point. Alarm actually incites very positive action sometimes. Alarm is about, it's a threat of negative consequences, but it can drive very positive behavior. For example, the Green Movement was not effective and was not widely adopted until enough people saw an inconvenient truth or saw what was happening at the gas pumps or reading enough in the news about the negative consequences of what was happening with fossil fuels so that they began to adopt new behavior. If you have a family history of a certain type of an illness, then you take preventative steps to stay out of the sun or have a healthier diet in order to prevent that. So it's alarm is great in terms of lifestyle. For marketers, though, alarm is when we say anything like raise your hand if you're sure. If you don't want to be unsure, or if you don't want to have yellow teeth, or you don't want to have bad breath, then you're going to buy a product to solve the problem. So alarm products and companies that use alarm are all about solving a potential problem, whether the problem is real or imagined. Life insurance or anything that has to do with protection is all about alarm.
Now, I noticed that the logo on your website is a hogshead. It's your last name. It helped me remember it. But beyond the memory aid, what's the point of having a hogshead? How does that tie into, how does it use one of these triggers? Or does it?
Well, okay. I mean, can you imagine growing up with the last name Hogshead? I mean, seriously, Hogshead, the head of a hog. People thought that it was a joke. They thought it was like a stage name. I was beat up on the playground like you wouldn't believe. And finally, my mom said to me, you know, stop looking in the white pages to find the name of somebody that you can one day marry into, like Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones, and understand that when your name is different than anybody else's name, and that's what's going to have people not only remember it, but it's going to start to mean something, and you create that meaning. And that's really the essence of fascination, is that things that are fascinating are polarizing. They create advocates. They have strong and immediate reactions that they bring out in us. And then it's okay to have something, in fact, oftentimes necessary, to be polarizing and not sit in the middle so that you can have a distinct and memorable perspective. So instead of changing my name, like many other hogsheads have done, wimps, I've leaned into it. And in fact, my business card says, a hogshead is a barrel that holds 62 gallons. So what's your last name, smartass?
I saw that on your website. I really love that line. So how are you polarizing? So far, the audience is loving you. I'm loving you. How are you polarizing? Or are you?
Well, polarization, first of all, we all believe in what I'm talking about. We all believe in this need to create powerful messages that people remember and act upon. So
yeah, I can't imagine anyone in the audience sitting there going, right, I don't want to be fascinating. This thing is a waste.
Yeah, make me forgettable. I want to be ignored and forgotten. Right. The ways in which I'm polarizing, for me, for my personal brand, in the book I outline six gold hallmarks of a fascinating person or brand or message. And the number one thing is to create a strong and immediate emotional response. So people, it's kind of a love it or hate it. The people that we remember that change our opinion, that get under our skin, and that make us not only remember them, but remember the message that they're trying to teach, tend to be very strong personalities. And for a long time in my career, I focused more on following the rules, and I focused on doing what was right, playing to strengths, and not so much using my talents, but using skills or using experience, like a traditional resume. And finally, I realized about 3 years ago that the greatest successes in my personal career had not come out of the times when I'd followed the rules, but when I had broken them. And that's when I began this this quest of figuring out why are certain things fascinating and certain things aren't. The other gold hallmarks of a fascinating brand include things like it generates conversation, that it elicits conversation. We want to talk about them. We want to find out what other people think about them. It also, they create advocates that people want to follow and learn more. And it might even be just a small sliver of the overall audience. But as long as there's 20%, 10%, 2% of the overall audience that's passionately dedicated to you and what you're doing, then you have advocates. Twitter is a perfect example of this, because if you have people who are willing to support you in the social media world and retweet you, then you're going to be more successful in that environment, as with any environment. It's not about being the lowest common denominator anymore. It's about having a message that breaks through and makes people want to champion it.
So how are you breaking the rules now?
Right now in this interview?
Right now in this interview, or now that you've discovered that your best successes have come when you've broken the rules, how are you doing it?
Well, here's a micro example. Okay. I didn't do a book tour. I didn't do the thing of, I haven't gone to a single bookstore and done signings. I did that with my first book, Radical Careering, and I loved doing it, but I instead decided to use social media by this conversation that we're having today. It instead of following the rules of publishing and going about it in a traditional way of going from city to city to city to city and talking to 100 people, 100 people, 100 people. Instead, I'm staying in my office and creating content and spending the focus on the message that I want to say instead of where I'm saying it.
Can I tell you, it used to be really hard for me to get authors to come on and do interviews here. They were looking for the Today Show, or they were looking for something, I guess, that was more,
more
maybe
mass
it felt
media.
Sorry?
More, well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's the question of mass media. I was talking to somebody. It's do I want to be on the Today Show, or do I want to develop an app that gets downloaded by 10 million people and that they use every single day and that then they share with other people and so on? It's a massive shift, because we're getting away from the traditional model. Remember before we talked about New York Times and Encyclopedia Britannica, and now it's Mixergy and Wikipedia. Yeah. It's going from an authority establishment-based model over to a fascination-based model.
Yeah, I think we're still in that transition, at least for many authors. They're still looking for that mainstream media hit. That's where they want to do their interview. The whole idea of getting on Skype is a little bit frightening. What if we look behind over your shoulder and say, that's where she's living? That's what she has over there? She's showing us a chair. We don't happen to have
that. Actually, no. Can I show you?
Yeah, I would love it.
Okay, so I wanted to make sure that we had a good broadband connection, because normally I have Wi-Fi in my apartment. So I'm in my kids' room right now. And the reason why I have this behind me is to hide the fact that I have over here, I have my ironing board, where I was literally ironing my shirt when you initially called me. It's a much more real way of having a discussion.
Oh, that's great. And guys, tell me if I'm wrong here, the connection today is fantastic.
I
wish everyone would just plug in. I plug in, you plugged in, the connection's fantastic. A couple of other guests have done that. It always, Andy Dang, there he is, saying absolutely. Agreed, says David.
What does Anthony think?
Excellent, says Shakao. Pedro, yep, yeah. Eddie agrees. Anthony agrees. And these are the people who, if the internet connection stinks, it stinks for them much worse than it does for me, because I'm getting it on my screen and then I have to broadcast it out to them. So right. On behalf of all of them, I'm saying thank you. Let's take a look here. What's next? Prestige. Here's another one that feels a little out of reach for a new company, especially one that doesn't have a ton of cash. How do you create prestige when you're a scrappy upstart?
Prestige is all about offering something that other people can't. I have something that's valuable, or I have done something or achieved something, or I can offer a level of quality that nobody else can. So a lot of times an entrepreneurial startup might, the founder may have an MBA from Stanford, or they may have experience working in Silicon Valley at a particular company, or the company may have a lifetime guarantee on a product that they're eliciting not only prestige by giving away a promise that nobody else can make, and weaving in trust with that. But they could also have, it's a way of elevating within any group, whether it's a peer group, a competitive set, or a group of product offerings, to elevate one above the others. So,
Can you raise your camera just a little bit? Ted is saying that your head's getting cut off in the video. Oh. And now just a little bit lower. All right, there.
Do we get to limbo?
Yeah, perfect. There we go. I take information better in when it's attached to an example. Do you have an example of a company that's doing prestige really well?
Let's see. Online, a company with prestige, it's easy to track if somebody has prestige in social media because it's so transparent on how many followers somebody has, how many likes a page has, how much commentary there is on a particular topic. That translates to prestige in the social media world, because it's prestigious to have Ashton Kutcher number of followers versus somebody who just begins. It's respected. It's a symbol of rank. If you think about 300 years ago, what symbols of rank used to include a family crest or a way of wearing the hair or a certain style of shoe, because not everybody could have it. Only a few people could have it. Now, with my 6-year-old, it's all about who has a certain Pokemon card or who can get to a certain level of play in a video game. In social media, prestige is very important because we associate somebody's rank with on the ad age rank number blank of this blog, or if they've won a certain Mr. Tweet sends you a notice, you've reached 10,000 followers, congratulations, or I endorse this person on Twitter. All of those are emblems of prestige.
I have to say, I think to some degree we do it well here at Mixergy. I get emails back from people after I do an interview with them who say, wow, it just feels great to be on the same website as, and then they list like Jimmy Wales, who's up at the top of the page, and Paul Graham and the others. I think a lot of people assume that I put those pictures up on the page because I want to get the click-through. I don't care about the click-through. I just want the potential guests and the past guests to come on the website and say, ah, I know these guys. These are guys who are only interviewed by the top, or they make decisions that I admire. If they decided to do an interview with Andrew, I'm really going to be proud to be associated with Andrew.
That's a great example of prestige. Those are badges that indicate that you are not like every other blog invitation. The fact that I think there is something crazy like 130,000 people view your interviews, I mean, that's tremendous prestige in the online world, because it means that you have the power to offer something that not everybody else can. And so that gives you, speaking of power, that gives you the ability to entice a certain quality of guest, which perpetuates the prestige of the site.
And another example that I saw of somebody doing this really well is there's a company that came into Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is a tough area to break in, and the startup world in Los Angeles, I think, it's starting to get loud. What these guys decided to do was organize their own event, have only 10 people come out to dinner, just do dinner, not do 100 people for a big event, and then it's who they selected for the dinner, how they get to sit next to each other. You know what, actually? There's an example of somebody who I can mention. I didn't think I could mention the person who put that dinner together, but Peter Pham, I did an interview with him. He used to have these dinners in LA, maybe 15 people. He'd invite the most interesting entrepreneurs, the guys who really had something big going on. He invited the venture capitalists. He invited a couple of other people. And if you listen to that interview, you can see why he was able to make so many contacts. He really, he created a prestigious event.
That's a great example, Andrew, of like TED. TED is the most prestigious place for a speaker to attend, or even to get an invitation to attend.
Yeah. Now, TED feels a little out of reach. I always go for the smaller examples because I feel like
it's TEDx.
You think, all right, if they could do it, I can do it. But I think you're right. I should be thinking more about the big size events like TED. How do you create something that prestigious, that big, that earth-changing? Mm-hmm. Finally, Vice. You said Vice is your personal favorite earlier. Why?
Vice is so essential for standing out in a world in which you don't have the biggest budget. Mm-hmm. If you're already the category leader, you don't need to use Vice, because what you're trying to do is to perpetuate people's habits. You don't need to create or change a new style of thinking. What you need to do is just keep people ingrained in buying from the same place, reaching for the same cereal box of cornflakes that they always have, or just reinstating their same phone plan. Vice comes in when we want to get people to look at the other side of how something could go, to look at other possibilities, to say, over here, come on, I want to take you away from what you've been doing and bring you over here to what you could be doing. So emerging technologies use Vice. Anytime there's a new type of plan that breaks with convention or breaks expectations or introduces a new pricing model, all of this rests in the same instinctive triggers that cause us to want to order two desserts or do something we're told we shouldn't. Or, you know, it's like if I say, okay, here's a box, don't look in here, whatever you do, don't, there's a pee, that's all I'm gonna show you. That kind of, that curiosity that is brought out in you, of the mystique of what's in the box, but also the fact that I said, don't do it, makes you wanna do it more.
Okay, I have one other one that we didn't talk about. Well, we kinda did, we talked about trust a little bit. So tell you what, we now talked about how to use this in business. You intrigued me early on when you said, why don't we talk also about how this could work with families and friendships? I think it'd be interesting to see how can you use these persuasion techniques, these persuasion triggers with friendships, with interpersonal, in relationships.
Can I give you a personal example from my own life?
Please.
Okay, so my daughter Azalea, who's six, hates vegetables, will not eat vegetables. Now, how might I use the seven triggers to get her to eat vegetables? I could use lust by taking, let's say we're using Brussels sprouts. Well, what's your least favorite vegetable, Andrew?
I can't think of one. I love vegetables. I hate to say it. I love vegetables.
Brussels sprouts are the opposite of a crowd pleaser.
I eat Brussels sprouts right out of the Trader Joe's bag.
You do?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Wow. I will bring them into a movie theater if I can. But you know what? The audience couldn't identify with me and that feeling Andy Dang's cracking up to. Let's suppose that Andrew didn't like Brussels sprouts. How would you make Brussels
sprouts? First of all, I need to hook you up with Azalea. But so I might use lust by taking the Brussels sprouts and I would steam them so they're really green, so they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. I might arrange them on her plate in a way that's kind of fun, that it makes her want to interact with it. Or I might use a cheese sauce so that there's some other element that's making her desire to eat those. I might use prestige by pitting her in a competition against her brother by saying, ooh, I wonder who can eat the most Brussels sprouts. I might use alarm by saying, if you don't eat those Brussels sprouts in the next 5 minutes, then you're gonna go to bed without supper. I might use trust by saying, if you eat those Brussels sprouts, I will read your favorite book to you before you go to bed, the one that we've read every night for 2 years. I might use vice by saying, ooh, you can't have any Brussels sprouts, I'm gonna eat all the Brussels sprouts. So you can start to see that you can take these and you can take these principles, and we use them all the time, every day. You're using all seven triggers every day, all the time, without even realizing it. The question is, can you start to do it in a more practiced intentional way when you want to get a certain type of response, when you want to create a specific behavior.
Yeah, I'd like to be able to use this almost to just to call it out as a skill. Just be able to call on this as a skill and be able to use it in life and in business.
Wait, hold on. Can I add to that?
Uh-huh.
The trick here, it's not even so much, it's taking something that you're already doing, something that you're already born with, this amazing God-given set of tools that you have, and figuring out how can you take what you're already doing and doing it intentionally so that you can have better relationships and better communication. Because it's not just about marketing. It's also about having deeper connections. Because when people are fascinated, they feel connected to you. Their barriers lower. They're less resistant. They're less cynical. They're less distrustful. It allows you to merge with them. It's like that feeling of falling in love. You know, when you fall in love with somebody and it feels like you are one, there's something essentially connected there that goes so far beyond the words. It has to do with a belief system, whether it lasts for 10 minutes or it lasts for a 50-year wedding anniversary. That's really what we're talking about here, is the ability to do that at will instead of having it be a happy accident.
That's what I meant, yes. I would like to create all those feelings that you just described there at will and not just have it be an accident and have it happen
right.
in situations that I care about and not just in whatever situations happen to create those feelings.
Business is artificial. I mean, the business world, it's almost easy to apply it there. The bigger question is, how can we take these natural strengths that we have, figure out which ones we're already using, which ones speak to our natural strengths, and use them more, which is why I developed the F-score personality test.
I just brought that up on my screen. What is the F-score? By the way, before we go into that, Ted here in the audience is saying, no offense, but I don't think she needs Andrew for this interview today. All right, I agree. There's some pieces that I really, really have to work to bring any information out of and to bring any energy out of. And at the end of the interview, I sometimes wish I could just delete it. And then there are people like you who I could just sit back here, have my yerba mate, and understand that you're going to treat my audience well. You're going to give us good information that we can use, and you're going to do it in a way that's engaging. So, Ted, I'm not offended by that. The truth is the truth. Okay, so what is this this F score?
This concept of fascination, I spent all this time figuring out how does it apply in business and in the corporate world, but really it comes down to something that is much more personal than that. In your personality, if you think about, if you think of each trigger as beakers in a chemistry set. If you think of, there's a chemistry set in front of you and you have a beaker of lust and a beaker of trust and a beaker of vice and so on. And some of those beakers are going to be very full and some of them are going to be very empty. I wanted to give people a way to measure how full are your different beakers? What are your ratios or the triggers that you just naturally use? When you're being yourself, when you're being your most persuasive, which triggers do you use? And so we did a study of 1,000 people around the country, and we wanted to find out how people respond to certain triggers, how they feel when they're using those triggers, and which ones they respond to. And we boiled it down to a very simple test. It's only 28 questions. It only takes about 5 minutes to do. And this personality test helps you figure out which triggers you're using when you're being your most persuasive and which ones you're the least likely to use, which is not to say that you should use those, just that it's good to know which ones are dormant within your personality.
Yep, and I took this test before the interview. It's a very easy test.
Wait, can I guess?
Yes,
I guess?
Actually. Okay. Absolutely. Before you do, I was gonna ask where can people see the test, but Sarah in the audience apparently found the link. It's on sallyhogshead.com. If you go to sallyhogshead.com, you'll see the link on the page, but she's linking to the specific page, sallyhogshead.com/f-score-personality-test. You don't even need it. Sarah, thank you for the link. All you need to do is go to sallyhogshead.com. Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah, props to Sarah because she's the first woman that we've talked to, that we've heard from today. So I'm sending you a woo-woo. sallyhogshead.com/f-score. Abbreviated perfect. URL. So on this test, as you're doing the test asks you questions about how you interact with other people, how you're likely to behave, how you make decisions, how you affect other people's personalities. And we've been culling the test down to the most powerful questions. And what we
found in the audience, do you want to take a guess? You've known me for a long time. Do you want to guess which of these triggers is the one that I've got a full beaker of? And Sally, you and I now have known each other for an hour. What do you
That's
think? Which
right.
one?
I'm going to guess it's power prestige, but I also think you have some vice because you think about things from a very counterintuitive perspective a lot, and you're unafraid to put yourself out there in a way that brings a br brings a you don't shy away from a conflicting perspective. You draw things out of other people, but I also think there's a little bit of lust in there. What I don't see as much are the alarm triggers, and I would guess that trust might be your dormant trigger, not because you're untrustworthy, but because you don't get into ruts. You don't do the exact same thing over and over again.
All right, yes, you're right. Trust wasn't in there. Apparently, I'm untrustworthy, people. But.
Wait, can I say trust is the most difficult, the most rare trigger to earn? Because for personalities, it's incredibly difficult to behave the same way over and over again to earn the consistency. People with trust are like the golden labs of human beings. Trust is the most common dormant trigger, meaning the most people use the least trust. Because we, especially people who are online, who use social media and are taking the test, tend to not be people who pride themselves on being predictable. So what
So,
else?
Mike B is saying vice, Andy Dang is saying prestige. The answer is what you said, which is power. That was my primary trigger.
What
My
was your secondary?
secondary is vice. I'm apparently the rebellious streak.
I knew it! Yay! You want to know a secret? I'm power vice too, dormant trust. So you and I have the same combination, which
So,
is
what's your number one?
but I'm power
Oh.
primary
Oh, power
vice.
vice.
Power vice, that's what I'm
Look at
saying, dude.
that.
Or like mono e mono.
What is
It's
your, let's see, what's that last one? The dormant trigger for you is what?
trust. Same
Trust,
as you.
okay.
Dormant is trust. And here's the thing to note. That's not a common combination. The reason why I anticipated that that might be yours is because there are certain personality traits. Once you understand somebody's F score, it tells you so much about that person. There's not one combination that's better than another combination. There's no there, there there's nothing good or bad about a certain combination. But if somebody has a say a mystique vice combination, that would be somebody that plays everything very close. They don't give away a lot. They are not going to be the one to announce themselves at a party. And if they break the rules, they're not going to let anybody else know that they're doing it. As opposed to power vice is going to use the fact that they're tweaking a norm to become more powerful and to use that for authority and control.
Yeah, if I'm at a party, everyone's gonna know that I'm at a party, so I could not have mystique. My dormant trigger is alarm. All right, let me suggest this, guys. If you're listening to us, go check out this test. Take the test. I just told you what mine are, what my triggers are. Tell me what yours are. If you email me your triggers, and we can keep this all private. If you email me your triggers, I will email you my trigger, and we'll do it for a limited time because I don't want to get involved with people coming back to me a year later asking me for my triggers. Let's say a week after I post this is the deadline. So do it. I'll email you all the information about me. You'll really get to know me, and I'll find out who's in my audience.
Nice.
Sally, how
Oh,
could
wait,
you?
I have an idea. I
Yes.
have an idea. I have an idea. Okay.
Please.
So can we create a specific code? In fact, I'm gonna let's just make it let's just we'll make the code Andrew. So we will set up. We'll set it up. I'll set it up immediately after this call. If people put the code Andrew in there, then what that means is all of your listeners' results will be aggregated in one place, and we'll be able to do a detailed analysis that we can give to you that you can post to demonstrate how your listeners' triggers are different than the norm. Like for example, I just did, we do I do this when I speak at conferences, and I just spoke at a conference. I think it was 28% of them had lust as their number one trigger. Well, next week I'm speaking to a group of attorneys. For them, lust is their dormant trigger. They're all about power prestige, which makes sense, right? Lust is all about emotion and passion and intuition and right brain thinking. Power prestige is more about a rational right or wrong style of thinking. So it'd be very interesting to see what your group comes up with.
I see. And you'll be able to tell me, and then I could tell them.
Exactly,
Okay.
and it'll graphically be broken out.
Will you tell it to them at the end of them taking the test, or do I need to email it to them?
they'll be able to find out their own results at the end of the test. If they want to get what are called advanced results, which means they get these cool little graphic pie charts of exactly how their results compare to other to the overall group of participants, they can get that. But they won't be able to see what their breakdown is compared to it within their own Andrew group.
Okay, Ted's asking, where does the code go? It goes at the last page. By the way,
I haven't put in the code yet.
Oh, sorry. Oh, she hasn't put it in. So, guys, wait till after this interview is done if you're doing it live. But, guys, I don't think I need to say this, but I'm going to say it. There's no affiliate program attached to this. There's no benefit to me attached to this.
No, it's totally free.
I'm just saying, let's just try this all for fun. And here's what I will do. If you take the test and you email me your results, we could do it quietly by email. I will email you back my results. And then once I figure out what my audience is like, I will tell you how crazy, power hungry, or how alarm hungry, or how mystique hungry my audience is. So try it. You can email it to me. My email address is right on the website. She's actually blackberrying to get Andrew as a code up there now, but wait for a little bit so we can get it on there. Oh, there. Oh, she's iPhoning it.
Yeah.
All right. So it's just sallyhogshead.com. Take that test. Send me the results. I will send you my results. We will compare. We'll find out what the audience is like, and I will tell you about my audience. Sally, thanks for doing Mixergy. Thanks for coming on here.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been so fun. I love it.
This has really been a lot of fun.
Advisor.
All right. Sally and I are going to be doing an interview a week for the next year. We're going to be building up an audience through intrigue. We'll just be sending out questions and revealing the answers only at the end. If you guys want to sponsor and put an ad in between that little period of mystique wonder, talk to me.
All right. Fun.
That's not happening. So for now, if you want to check out Sally, get the book. It is, let me make sure that I'm reading exactly right because I copied it wrong before. It's Fascinate, Your 7 Triggers to Persuasion and Captivation. And the website is sallyhogshead.com. All right. Thank you all for watching. I'm Andrew. I'll see you on the website.